His face hurt like hell. He looked at the pain, and he set himself apart from it. He saw it, examined it, identified it, corralled it. He isolated it. He challenged it. You against me? Dream on, pal. He built borders for it, then walls. He built walls and forced the pain behind them, and then he moved the walls inward, compressing the pain, crushing it, boxing it in, limiting it, beating it. Not beating it. It was beating him. It was exploding like bombs on timers. One, two, three, relentlessly, everlastingly, with every beat of his heart. It was never going to stop until his heart stopped. It was insane. In the past, he had been wounded with shrapnel and shot in the chest and cut with knives. This was worse. Much worse. This was worse than all of his previous sufferings put together. Which made no sense. No sense at all. Something was wrong. He had seen busted noses before, many times. No fun, but nobody made a gigantic fuss about them. Nobody looked like grenades were going off in his head, not even Seth Duncan. People got up, maybe spat a little, winced, walked it off. He raised his hand to his face, slowly. He knew it would be like shooting himself in the head, but he had to know, because something was wrong. He touched his nose. He gasped, loud and sudden, like an explosive curse, pain and fury and disgust. The ridge of bone on the front of his nose was broken, clean off. It had been driven around under the tight web of skin and cartilage to the side. It was pinned there, like a mountaintop sliced off and reattached to a lower slope. It hurt like hell. Maybe the Remington's butt had a metal binding, brass or steel, reinforcement against wear and tear he hadn't noticed. He knew he had turned his head at the last split second as much as he could against the resistance of the sweaty palm clamped on his forehead. He had wanted as much of a side-on impact as he could get, better than head-on. A head-on impact could drive shards of loose bone into the brain. He closed his eyes. He opened them again. He knew what he had to do. He had to reset the break. He knew that. He knew the costs and the benefits. The pain would lessen, and he would end up with a normal-looking nose. Almost. But he would pass out again, no question about that. Touching the injury with a gentle fingertip had nearly taken his head off at the neck, like shooting himself. Fixing it would be like machine-gunning himself. He closed his eyes, the pain battered at him. He laid his head gently on the concrete. No point in falling back and cracking his skull as well. He raised his hand. He grasped the knob of bone, finger, and thumb. Atom bombs went off in his head. He pushed and pulled. No result. The cartilage was clamping too hard, like a web of miniature elastic straps holding the damn thing in place. In completely the wrong place. He blinked water out of his eyes and tried again. He pushed and pulled. Thermonuclear devices exploded. No result. He knew what he had to do. Steady pressure was not working. He had to smack the knob of bone back into place with the heel of his hand. He had to think hard and set it up and be decisive. Like a chiropractor wrestling a spine, jerking, suddenly listening for the sudden click. He rehearsed the move. He needed to hit low down on the angle of cheek and nose, with side of his hand, the lower part, opposite the ball of his thumb like a karate chop, a semi-glancing blow, upward and sideways and outward. He needed to drive the peak back up the mountainside. It would settle, okay. Once it arrived, the skin and the cartilage would keep it in place. He opened his eyes. He couldn't get an angle. Not down there on the floor. His elbow got in the way. He dragged himself across the smooth concrete, palms and heels pushing 5 feet, 10, and he sat up against a wall, half reclining, his neck bent, space for his elbows in the void under his angled back. He squared his shoulders and his hips, and he got as settled and as stable as he could so that he wouldn't fall far, or even at all. Showtime. He touched the heel of his hand to where it had to go. He let it feel what it had to do. He practiced the move. The top of his palm would skim his eyebrow, like a guide. On three, he thought. One. Two. Crack! Black. Chapter 43. Mahmani's man was afraid. He had driven around for 20 minutes, and he had seen nothing at all. And then he had come to a house with a white mailbox with Duncan written on it, all proud and spotlit. The house was a decent place, expensively restored. Their HQ, he had assumed. But no, all it contained was a woman who claimed she knew nothing. She was relatively young. She had been beaten recently. She said there were 4 Duncans, a father and a son and 2 uncles. She was married to the son. They were all currently elsewhere. She gave directions to a cluster of 3 houses that Mahmani's man had already seen and dismissed from his mind. They were unimpressive places, all meanly hemmed in by an old post and rail fence, unlikely homes for men of significance. But he had set off back in that direction anyway, driving fast, almost running down some idiot pedestrian who loomed up at him out of the dark, and then from the 2-lane he had seen a gasoline fire blazing to the north. He had ignored the 3 houses and hustled onward toward the fire, and found it was in the motel lot. It was a car. Or it had been a car. Now it was just a superheated cherry red shell inside an inferno. Judging by the shape, it had been the 4 that Safir's boys had been driving. They were still inside it, or what was left of them was still inside it. They were now just shrunken and hideous shapes, still burning and melting and peeling. Their ligaments shriveled, their hands forced up by the heat, like ghastly claws, the furious roiling air in which they were sitting, making it look like they were dancing and waving in their seats. Rossi's boys had killed them, obviously, which meant they had killed Oscar, too, almost certainly, hours ago. Rossi's plan was clear. He already had a firm connection with the Duncans at the bottom end of the chain. Now he intended to leapfrog both Safir and Mahmani and sell to the Saudis direct at the top end of the chain. An obvious move, displaying sound business sense. But Rossi had had his boys start early. They had seized the initiative. A real coup. Their timing was impressive, as were their skills.